Hi, if you like classical music, fast and thrilling or slow and lyrical, please join me, Jerry Cowhig, on BCFM 93.2 every Thursday lunchtime from 12 till 2. My guests will talk about what's on in Bristol, theatre and art, as well as concerts, and I'll play lots of great classical tracks. The Jerry Cowhig Show, every Thursday on BCFM from 12 till 2.
Love Bristol.
Love, love, love.
BCFM 93.2.
What was Rome? A republic? What kind of republic? A constitutional republic. They had a constitution. It was a republic. What happened to Rome? It fell into oligarchy, and then into dictatorship, then into rampant immorality, declined, fell, and became the Vatican.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A 9/11 breakthrough in the US court system this week, and more evidence of Israel being behind the attacks from US author Chris Bolin. Yes, this week it's announced that a grand jury will be convened to look deeper into the collapses of Building 1, 2 and 7. Yes, and 7 for the first time in the United States. The court system actually looking at what really happened on 9/11. What a test to see if the whole justice system in the US is a facade. Ukraine and Russia clash off Crimea. What were those three Ukrainian naval ships up to? Does this have anything to do with the Ukrainian presidential elections? Petro Poroshenko, the president now, being rated only 8% in the polls. And the Russian military say British special forces are in Ukraine now, preparing a chemical weapons attack. Why and where? And can we believe what the Russian military are saying? And whatever happened to the people that scoured Iraq for weapons of mass destruction? Do you remember that? Back in 2002 and early 2003? What do they think of the state of the Middle East and what the illegal invasion of Iraq has done today? Also, a new religion was created this year, that of artificial intelligence, created by a former Google executive, as well as Facebook and Google also being hauled through the courts this week. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM at noon on Tuesday. Next week, that's the Illuminati special, both from a Freemason and from a non-Mason, pulling this organisation apart historically and, if it still exists, possibly today as well. Listen here on BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday, or you can download that now from dialectradio.co.uk. Start, Martin, with this news from the US about a new investigation into the September the 11th attacks.
Yeah, I think it's fairly significant. It looks as architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth are heavily involved in this, but they've got some top lawyers who've managed to get a grand jury empaneled to look into their allegations about what happened on the day. So I think it's a fairly significant development. As you know, the US is a very litigious, legalistic place. And, you know, the people have put a lot of work in to get this far.
Let's have a listen now to one of those people who's got this going, got the lawyers interested, got the courts interested and getting a grand jury going. That's Barbara Honecker.
This is Barbara Honecker. I am a board member of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry here in the United States. And we have just had a true historic breakthrough for 9/11 Truth and Justice. And the gist of that is that on November 7th of this year, 2018, the U.S. Attorney for the Federal Court in the Southern District of New York, which is the jurisdiction for Ground Zero and for the World Trade Center attacks on September 11th of 2001, the U.S. Attorney sent the Lawyers Committee a letter stating that the law requires them to present our petition demanding a new federal special criminal grand jury to investigate the true causes of the collapses of World Trade Centers 1, 2, and 7, and that they will be doing so.
Barbara, you're a private individual. Surely this should be a criminal prosecution that is being run by the federal government. Why hasn't that happened?
Well, the government did, quote, investigate, unquote, and those are the two cover-up commissions. The Joint House-Senate Intelligence Committee investigation, which produced the 850 or so page report, of which the final chapter, the 28 pages, were classified and hidden away by both the Bush-Cheney and Obama-Biden administrations for almost 16 years. And then the 9/11 Commission, which was a cover-up. The government has done its, quote, investigations, unquote. And so us public citizens in the United States to take the legal action to force the government to do this. The good news is that they have agreed to send our petition, which is at the website www.lcfor911.org. They have agreed to send our petition, which your listeners can read in full there, along with 57 attached evidentiary exhibits. All of that will be going to 23 grand jurors in the not-too-distant future. That is a major success.
Well, there's a lot of work gone into this, as you can see. I mean, there are various organisations now that are pursuing this. Architects and Engineers, obviously a very reputable organisation full of architects and engineers, but you've got the Lawyers for 9/11 Truth, you've got Pilots for 9/11 Truth. My particular favourite is Military Officers for 9/11 Truth. Eventually,
isn't it a guy called Stubblebine, a former general?
Stubblebine is the most senior US military person.
He's
a major general. He's out there on YouTube. You can see what he's got to say about this. Eventually, this is going to come back and bite them in the bum. Of course it is.
What about the BBC? Because we've seen, I mean, Barbara made a big point there of saying, well, Building 7 needs a proper investigation. The BBC actually did a programme in their Conspiracy Files series produced by Mike Rudin, which said, actually, there's nothing to see here. It just fell down, this building, and fires brought it down, so it can't possibly have been controlled demolition.
Well, the architects and engineers, as I say, stuffed with architects and engineers who actually build these buildings for
the
a
BBC,
living, don't agree.
Why would the BBC be saying, nothing to see here?
Because the BBC is basically a controlled news outlet. I mean, there are some good programmes on the BBC. I think of some of the documentaries and wildlife that are produced in this city and so on. But their news output is very heavily slanted by, intelligence services and so forth. That doesn't mean that it's completely lies. I mean, Fox News is the alternative, and the BBC are better than that, but they're not much better. And the reality is that they haven't looked at any of this properly. That Conspiracy Files series was essentially a hit job on anybody who's questioning the official story. And that's all you can say about it.
Sussex University professor, Emeritus Professor Kees van der Peel was he's written a book about Bilderberg as well, I seem to remember, from the 1990s. He's been censured, or there's an attempt to get him removed from Sussex University for suggesting, even daring to suggest, that maybe the Israelis were behind the 9/11 attacks.
Well, I mean, there's evidence to suggest that they were definitely involved, not least the five dancing Israelis who all turned out to be Mossad agents and even went on television in Israel saying, yes, we were Mossad agents, but all we were doing was documenting the attack. But of course, to document the first plane hitting the first building meant that they knew the plane was going to hit the building. That's what they were doing. They were videoing it. And they were arrested. And they said, yes, well, we weren't doing anything out of the order. We were just documenting the attack. A surprise attack that nobody knew about was going to happen, apparently. Although they did know it was going to happen.
This is actually about 3 weeks ago, 6th of November, the Daily Mail reporting, Sussex University is investigating a professor who claims Israel was behind the 9/11 Twin Towers attacks with help from Zionists in the US government. Professor Professor Kees van der Peel, bless him, his tweet was immediately met with mocking replies, used as a source conspiracy site. Also claims Al-Qaeda is a front of Mossad. Sussex University said it's aware of the Facebook post on 3rd of November. They seem a bit confused as to whether this really was a tweet or a Facebook post, but he's the former head of International Relations Department at Sussex University, Martin.
Well, obviously an ignoramus who knows nothing, Tony, so we can just ignore him.
He was responding to an article criticising US sanctions on Iran. He was immediately inundated with a storm of mocking tweets, including one that joked, "Yes, and Bruce Lee was the first man on the moon."
Well, that sort of remark from people who know nothing about NATO intelligence services and their operations going back decades, the Bologna bombing of 1980, which the Italian police and the Italian courts, including the former head of the Italian Supreme Court in Pozzimati, pointed the finger firmly at NATO intelligence services for that attack. That was in 1980, killed 86 people. They've been doing this for years. The idea that they don't do this sort of thing is just for the, strictly for kiddies, and there's plenty of kiddies out there.
Tricked into war, that's the latest presentation by Christopher Bolin, who's the author of a book called Solving 9/11. He makes it absolutely clear that he believes for many years the evidence is very strong that the Israelis were very much involved, if not the main perpetrators behind the 9/11 attacks, and here's why.
So I'm going to point out some of the key connections, Israeli connections to 9/11. One of the first ones is that when Israel was becoming a state in 1948, before it became a state, the Joint Chiefs of Staff did 13 papers about what this would mean for the American military. And they wrote in the 13th paper that the Zionist strategy will seek to involve the U.S. in a continuously widening and deepening series of operations intended to secure maximum Jewish objectives. And the maximum Jewish objectives were the expansion of Eretz Israel, that means the land of Israel, into Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, and the establishment of Jewish military and economic hegemony over the entire Middle East. Well, this is what's going on today, and this is what the United States is facilitating. This is the short list of Israeli terrorism attacks prior to 9/11. In 1944, they killed the British minister Lord Moyne in Cairo. This was done by Lehi, or the Stern Gang. In 1946, they sent letter bombs to British officials, including the foreign minister Ernest Bevin. In 1946, they bombed the King David Hotel, killing 93 people. That was British Mandate headquarters. It was under the British at that time. In 1947, Irgun placed a bomb at the Colonial Office in London, which failed to detonate. In 1947, Leahy sent letter bombs to the Truman White House. In 1948, Irgun and Haganah bombed the Semiramis Hotel, killing 26 people. And in 1948, Irgun and Leahy massacred the entire village of Deir Yassin. That's all before Israel even became a state. This is the bombing of the King David Hotel. That's Menachem Begin. This was the worst terror. This was the worst terrorist attack in Israeli-Palestinian history to this point. Then Irgun bombed the British Embassy in Rome in October 1946. So they were global in their reach. They would go to London. They would go to Britain. They would go to Italy. They would even send bombs to America. They sent bombs to the Truman White House. And this is one of the bombers. This is Yitzhak Shamir. He was the head of Lehi. He was the head of the Stern Gang when they killed this man, the UN mediator, Volker Bernadotte, in 1948. Now, when Menachem Begin came to the United States in 1948 in December, Albert Einstein penned a letter with 26 Jewish intellectuals about what Americans should know about the Israeli terrorists, the Jewish terrorists. He was talking about Menachem Begin's party at the time, and he said, "The public avowals of Begin's party are no guide whatsoever to its actual character. Today they speak of freedom, democracy, and anti-imperialism, whereas until recently they openly preached the doctrine of the fascist state. It is in its actions that the terrorist party betrays its real character. From its past actions, we can judge what it may be expected to do in the future." Bingo. Now, if Americans had paid attention to what Einstein told them in 1948, we would not have had 9/11. Because the same people are involved. The very same party, ideology, and people. What happened is that these terrorists, these are the terrorists of Zionism. Begin, Shamir, Sharon. They came to power in 1977. I happened to live in Israel at the time, and this was a very sad day for labor people because they said, this is the day that the terrorists have taken power. They knew what they were talking about. Then the terrorists went to work right away. Begin invaded Lebanon in 78, and there was a Palestinian attack in Nahariya, and the response was, this man said, kill them all. And they set up a terrorist squad that operated in Lebanon for 4 years. And this is Chief of Staff Rafael Eitan, and he set up an organization called the Front for the Liberation of Lebanon from Foreigners, in which he used car bombs and truck bombs to destroy Palestinian and Syrian targets and to foment conflict between the various ethnic groups of Lebanon. It was very successful. He did it for 4 years. This was revealed in a recent book that came out this year, Rise and Kill First, by an Israeli author named Ronan Bergman. New York Times bestseller. But when they interviewed Ronan Bergman, the New York Times, and when they write about the book, they leave out that little bit of history, that Israel was using a terrorist squad. They would hire, they would recruit people from the Sunni community, the Shiite community, Druze community, to drive the trucks, and then they would blow them up in places that they needed to blow them up. Because this is not discussed in American media, because this shows that Israel is a state that has openly practiced terrorism. We now, there's no question about it. Remember the years, 1979 to 1983. And they say that the aim was to cause chaos amongst the Palestinians and Syrians in Lebanon without leaving an Israeli fingerprint. To give them the feeling that they were constantly under attack and instill them with a sense of insecurity. This is exactly the same strategy that was applied to Iraq in the 1990s and in since the war. Remember, car bombs going off every day between the communities, driving the people against each other. And this is exactly what they did to us after 9/11. The bombing in Bali, the bombing in Madrid, the bombing in London, 9/11. So that they went global then, and they wanted to put fear into the entire Western world, that we're all insecure. And that's exactly what the terrorism is all about. They want us to feel insecure so that we will support their war agenda. Then in 1983, a nondescript group that had never been heard of before bombed U.S. Marine barracks in Beirut, killing 241 Marines. Caspar Weinberger, Defense Secretary at the time, said there is no knowledge, we have no knowledge about who did the bombing. This is exactly the same time that Israel was doing exactly this. And we now know from Victor Ostrowski, who wrote Mossadnik, who wrote about Mossad's actions in a book by Way of Deception, he said that Mossad knew the specific time and location of the bombing, but only gave the U.S. skimpy general information, which was worthless. So they knew about the bomb, they knew what it was going to be, where it was going to be, what the truck looked like, but they didn't tell us. That's like either let it happen on purpose or made it happen on purpose. And it's the worst, it's the largest loss of life among the U.S. Marines since Iwo Jima. Here are a couple of Israeli terrorists from the 1950s. This is Shimon Peres, Pinhas Lavon, and Moshe Dayan. These two characters play a big role in Israeli history, especially in the use of false flag terrorism. This photograph was taken a few months after they were busted for the Lavon affair in Egypt, when they put bombs, nitroglycerin bombs, in American libraries and British libraries and cinema theaters and cultural institutions in Cairo in an attempt to drive the British and the Americans away from Nasser, away from Egypt. But they were caught, and they're still smiling. Shimon, after it was discovered by the Prime Minister at the time, Moshe Sheret, he said that Shimon Peres shares the same ideology as Pinhas Lavon. He wants to frighten the West into supporting Israel's aims. And this is exactly where we are today. The whole name of the game of the terrorism is to scare us into supporting Israel's aims, to drive us as a nation, as a people, as a military, right behind the Israel camp, so that we become the fighters of their wars for them, because we are affected by the fear.
Well, I think that's a pretty accurate assessment. I think he's underestimating the role of NATO intelligence services in these provocations as well. Mossad are part of an infrastructure which also involves MI6, CIA, and so on.
It's so extraordinary that we hear very, very little about the whole history of Israeli terrorism on our TV screens.
Well, that's right, and it's not even just history. They're actually still engaged in it now. I mean, that book, Rise Up and Kill First, admits that they've carried out 2,500 assassinations in the last decade alone, and that's what they admit to. There's all sorts of other things which they haven't admitted to. The attack on the USS Liberty in 1967, when 30-odd US sailors were killed. That again was carried out by the Israelis.
What about that Einstein quote from 1948 calling the Israeli state fascist? He's actually, surely Einstein is an anti-Semite then?
No, Einstein is actually an honourable, I mean, you know, he had some, like most people, he had feet of clay. He was quite racist about Chinese and Japanese people, I understand. But he was absolutely right about the right wing in Israel. The right wing in Israel, basically, are the Jewish version of fascism. That's what they are. And the people say that can't exist. I say, well, anybody can be a fascist. You know, anybody can be, you know, communists can turn into fascists. Anybody can turn into fascists, can't they?
So if this evidence is proven, is it ever going to make any difference in the world? Do you think the Israelis are ever going to, real criminals, whoever they are going to ever have to pay for the 9/11 attacks and the massive war on terror they created?
Well, Alan Sabrowski, who used to be the head of studies at the US Army War College and is of Jewish extraction, because he's not actually Jewish, well, he was not brought up as Jewish. He was saying, well, if the American people realise that the Israelis carried out 9/11, then the state of Israel will be liquidated. And I think as World War III comes over the horizon, the people in the right wing in Israel who think they're going to win World War III need to have a look at the naval and think, are we really going to win this?
So how does 9/11 fit into this projected World War III you're talking about?
Well, what will happen if there is a run-in with the Russians, for example, is the Russians have got loads of information on this. Ivashov, who was the commander of the Russian armed forces on the day, has already made it clear that the Russians have got loads and loads of intel on this, and they'll just dump it onto the internet straight away. Everything they've got. They've got telephone intercepts, they'll have all sorts of stuff. Because at the minute, they're holding back because they're trying to do a deal with the West. But once that deal's off and the fighting starts, one of the first things going to happen is all this stuff's going to come out.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, we're going to talk now about Crimea and the naval action last weekend, which led to a whole load of Ukrainians being arrested, the boats being boarded by the Russians. Now, certainly it looks as if this is some sort of a Russian provocation.
Well, I think that's exactly the wrong way round. The boats are sailing into what is essentially Russian-controlled territory, and where they were seized was actually in Russian territorial waters, whether Crimea was in Russia or not. Yeah, they were actually in the Russian side of the strait, because that's the only place you can get through. It's very narrow, and it's very shallow. So there's only one place you can go through, and it's actually in the Russian. It's in the Russian side, just as the Strait of Hormuz, the actual place where you go through the Strait of Hormuz, is all in Iranian territorial waters. That's the case here. So in other words, they turned up to make a provocation, and they got what they wanted.
Craig Murray would beg to differ with you. He's tweeted. He was the head of maritime law at the Foreign Office. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Russian journalist Andrei Vilchek, who lives in Beirut and spends quite a lot of time in both Indonesia and South America as well. But he's a filmmaker, and in the next couple of weeks we'll be having a full interview with him on Dialect. But here's a little extract from that recorded earlier this week, where he gives his views on the Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko.
Everything that is happening in regards to Russia, I would always recommend to reverse the tables and imagine what would happen if the same violation would take place on the territory of the UK or the United States. Now, look, there is a very important political, telling political climate happening in Ukraine. Don't forget that in 3 months, in March, there will be presidential elections. Remember that Poroshenko, the president of Ukraine, has an approval rating of 8%. That according to all the information that I'm getting from Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, there will be problems with heating the flats. There are problems with drinking water, with electricity. The country is falling basically apart. So he has no way of winning presidential elections. That Tymoshenko is leading, there is even some actor, some comedian who didn't declare his candidacy or his attempt to run for president, and he's ahead of Poroshenko. The martial law which he declared, he was proposing 2 months, and he got only 1 month from the lawmakers, will mean that no criticism of the government will be allowed. So this will buy him at least 1 month of the time before the elections, and he has an opportunity to show himself as a macho man, you know, standing up to Russia with full support, of course, of totally indoctrinated European Union and NATO. Poroshenko cannot win presidential election with 8% approval rating. It's absolutely unthinkable. But what will happen to Tymoshenko, the candidate which is now leading, I don't know. But about Poroshenko, this man is absolutely criminal. This man is a ruthless businessman. And I went to actually to Africa, to West Africa, to Ivory Coast, because, you know, his nickname is the Chocolate King, right? I mean, he's basically he built the empire around chocolate industry, and you know he gets cocoa from Ivory Coast, and he's treating. I went to these plantations that he could. It's absolute disgrace. I mean, he's treating people there like in a slavery days, and basically, even in Ivory Coast, I was detained on many occasions. I was not allowed to work. I had to escape from my hotel, literally. It's a big mafia that is running the Ukraine, and it has its pals all over, you know, all the way to West Africa, where people are suffering, actually, because of these plantations.
That's Andre Vilcek there, Martin. I mean, what he's suggesting there is that actually Poroshenko is connected with a much, much wider mafia, and his little mafia is also active over in Africa too.
Yeah, and I don't think that Poroshenko and the Ukrainians have acted on their own here. I think elements within the CIA and MI6 have also been involved, because they want to sabotage the meeting which was going to take place between Trump and Putin in Buenos Aires. That's now been cancelled by Trump as a result of this incident. And that means, of course, that the Pentagon can breathe a sigh of relief. No chance of peace breaking out anytime soon.
Let's have another listen now to what Andre makes of the clash between these three ships. I suppose we ought to just explain, Martin, what happened is there is usually in this particular area, which is shared between Ukraine and Russia, but with this is now this bridge in the way and something called the Kerch Strait, that any naval ships from Russia that go in there, they tell the Ukrainians, and the other way around. But these three naval ships went through underneath the bridge and into that area without getting permission from the Russians first. At which point the Russians decide, right, okay, well, we're not going to... And there were, and of course, in the background, we've got these other threats that we've hearing from the Russian military, that the British SAS are over in Ukraine preparing a chemical attack.
Well, they've also openly threatened to blow up the bridge. So the Russians have got a reason to be paranoid. And, you know, they followed the procedure. A similar little flotilla in September came up to the bridge and followed the procedure, and the Russians waved them through because they followed the procedure. On this occasion, they didn't. Why not?
What we hear now, even from the Ukrainian side, is that these ships were staffed with the intelligence officers from Ukraine, and these people were directing the entire provocation against Russia for whoever they were doing it, either for Poroshenko himself or for NATO, because as we know, the West is doing everything possible to provoke Russia and China lately by all means. So Russian military is providing Security Council with all the digital data about the tracks of the ships and about the communication between these three Ukrainian ships and the Russian mainland. The facts are not given. It's only, again, some kind of a hysteria that is being produced in the West and, of course, in Ukraine. And I think the Ukraine is being sacrificed again, because to antagonize Russia is the worst thing that Ukraine can do. It's a historical part of Soviet Union. It used to be the same country. There are very close ties. And all the West is doing in the last years is provoking this rift.
We hear, don't we, that the Crimea area was annexed by Russia.
Annexed, it's not absolute nonsense again, because Crimea was part of Russia, it was part of Soviet Union, and in drunken stupor, Nikita Khrushchev at some meeting gave it to Ukraine simply because it was anyway the same country, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So it was just a little symbolic act. Then when the confrontation between Russia and Ukraine was heating, and it was clear that if Crimea is going to stay in Ukraine, then NATO is going to use the military bases and naval bases there, then what happened, Russia called for referendum, and because there is like close to 90% of Russians, the referendum was won by the Russian people. So it was just logical transfer back to where it was before the drunken stupor of Khrushchev and his absolutely symbolic act of giving it from one part of the country to another.
I suppose what remains, that's Andrei Velchek, by the way. You can find him online, Russian journalist working all over the world, filmmaker working, I think, most recently for Telesur English over in Venezuela. Martin, the main point here, though, is why impose martial law? Poroshenko wanted to do it for 2 months for an incident which is actually, you know, fair distance off the coast, a naval incident which has got nothing to do whatsoever with any need for martial law itself in Ukraine.
Well, they've only imposed it in the east Ukraine, in the basically what are Russian sympathetic areas. They've got the breakaway republics, and Alexander Zakachenko, who was the elected leader of, I think, the Donbass, he was killed in a bomb in August. And if, for example, the Russians had killed a senior Ukrainian politician with a bomb, they'd be going absolutely nuts. But apparently, and I suspect British Special Forces may have been involved in this incident, they can kill the other side's politicians, and the other side just have to suck it up.
So the Russians are accusing the British Special Forces of planning a chemical provocation of some kind in the east of Ukraine. Well, whether that's inside or outside of the Donbass area and Luhansk is another question. But what is that? Could that be a credible threat?
Well, I mean, the Russians were exposed exactly. There was actually a chemical weapons attack in Syria this week, in Idlib, and it was carried out by the rebels. And so nobody was killed, but quite a few people were affected. And the West totally ignored it because it was carried out by the rebels.
I mean, I found it very difficult to find this, but the Russian military definitely announced it. I'll put a link up on our show page to this Russian military announcement of the British over there planning a chemical weapons attack. Sounds incredible. Well, but
what the Russians are doing is they've got very good intel about what goes on, and when they see something like that being cooked up, they immediately go public on it to try and scotch it. Yeah, that's what they're doing. And they're actually doing a very good job of it. They were able to expose what's happened in Idlib because they have even said where the chemicals came from. They were brought in by the White Helmets, the supposed humanitarian organisation funded by NATO, and they brought in the chlorine that was used in this attack this week in Syria. Although it's completely ignored by the mainstream Western media. It definitely took place, and it was definitely carried out by the Al-Qaeda-linked rebels, who of course have been trained by British Special Forces. People don't really ask this. We've been doing this for years. Ask anybody in Belfast, they will tell you that's how the British are.
Yesterday, Britain is amongst 6 killed in a G4S compound in Kabul. Doesn't seem as if things are going all that swimmingly in Afghanistan, does it? All these years after, 17 years after the NATO invasion.
Well, the Russians, in fact, have just had a meeting in Moscow where they got the Taliban together with representatives of the current regime in Afghanistan to try and talk through a possibility of some kind of ceasefire and negotiated solution, which, of course, the Americans sent a low-level diplomat as an observer because they basically aren't interested. They basically want to have bases in Afghanistan to threaten the Chinese and the Russians with. That's why they're there.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
So let's have a listen now to Scott Ritter. He's the former UN weapons inspector. We haven't heard a lot from him since the early 2000s. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it was even 98, 99 when he was running around. He was actually working for the UN, even though he was an officer in the US Marine Corps, but he was trying to find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq.
Well, do you know what he said? He said, when I was working for the UN, I was actually working for the CIA. So when I pretended to be an independent UN weapons inspector, I was in fact working for the CIA, and he's come out and said blatantly that's what he was doing. And he said, you know what I was telling them back in Washington? There were no weapons of mass destruction. I kept telling them and telling them and telling them, but they weren't interested in the truth.
So what was going on there then? They'd already decided what was going
to
happen.
They wanted to raid Iraq, and that was what, you know, they were coming up with any excuse they could find.
Let's have a listen now to former UN weapons inspector Scott Ritter, who we should be hearing quite a lot from. But we're hearing virtually nothing, of course, from the mainstream press about him. He's disappeared off the face of the earth, apparently.
The war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan and Pakistan has cost at least 500,000 innocent lives.
Or more. I mean, I don't mean to laugh and minimize it, but the fact of the matter is the greatest threat to international peace and security is the American-led overreaction to the events of 9/11. I mean, we've basically triggered instability in the Middle East and in Central Asia that has manifested itself not in the elimination of terror, but the growth of terror. Al-Qaeda-inspired terrorist cells are global now. And the United States doesn't have, you know, a plan in place to successfully counter them. We're spending $700 billion a year on a defense program that can't defeat, you know, tens of thousands of lightly armed insurgents around the world. It's insane. But, you know, the lesson to be learned from this is the Security Council. I mean, the key here is the Security Council of the United Nations. It's a failed institution. It's an institution that has been and continues to be susceptible to corruption by its members, especially the five permanent members of the Security Council. What happened in 1991 with Iraq wasn't that the Security Council agreed on on the disarmament of Iraq. It's that the United States compelled the Security Council to vote in favor of a resolution it drafted to sustain its own, you know, national policy. This wasn't about the world doing the right thing in Iraq. This was about the United States using the United Nations to achieve its policy goals. And this situation exists today, whether it's Russia in Syria or the United States defending Israel. The Security Council is a fundamentally flawed institution. And if we want to have a truly international approach to collective security concerns, we're going to need to reform the Security Council and basically dismantle the post-World War II order that the Security Council preserves and seek to empower, you know, a different panel of nations. It probably will be inclusive of the United States, Russia, France, the UK, China, but will include nations like Germany, will include India, will include Brazil, maybe third world collectives. But
well, that may not be so far from reality, because there's been talk recently about potentially, because of Brexit, removing Britain, because Britain is not the power that it used to be in the world, from the Security Council. And also there's been sounds about maybe removing Russia from the UN Security Council because of some of their behaviour. What do you make of those two proposals?
Well, if you're going to remove Russia, you got to remove the United States. And if you're going to remove the United States, you got to remove the United Kingdom. If you're going to remove the United Kingdom, you got to remove China. No, I don't think behavior should be what decides. I think it should be, you know, the role that a nation plays in the international order. Because what we're talking about is a collective of nations sitting on a security council. That is a council that oversees security. If you remove Russia from the equation, how do you contain Russia then? Are you talking about the potential of the world going to war against Russia, inviting thermonuclear holocaust? That's about as absurd as it gets. So, no, that's stupidity personified, talking about removing these nations from the Security Council. You know, maybe Great Britain, because it's no longer the power that it once was, but Great Britain's voice should be heard perhaps through a European Union collective, you know, a representation of that nature, except, you know, with Brexit, it doesn't want to be part of that community anymore. So
I wonder, Scott, what you make of the potential conflict which seems to be brewing between Israel and Iran.
Well, I mean, I'm not one who's bought into the notion of Iranian malign activities. Iran is a regional power, a regional superpower. And as such, Iran has the same right to be concerned about what's transpiring in the region as any other nation. And if you take a look at what Iran's doing, what they're accused of doing, or they're guilty of doing. One is supporting the legitimate government of Syria against an illegitimate effort to remove it. I don't condemn Iran for being in Syria. They're seeking to stabilize a long-term ally. Unlike the United States present in Syria, Iran's been invited by the Syrian government. You take a look at what Iran's been accused of doing in Iraq. It was the United States who invaded Iraq and overthrew Saddam Hussein and created a vacuum, a power vacuum. Iran, a neighbor of Iraq who fought an eight-year war, had every right to step in and seek to stabilize that situation in a manner which was favorable to it. We did the same thing in Afghanistan. We toppled the Taliban government, creating a vacuum, and Iran is now actively involved in Afghanistan, seeking to create a stable situation that is favorable to its interests in Yemen, in the support of the Houthi. It's not Iran that started this war. It's Saudi Arabia that started this war. Iran's seeking stability. So when I look at Iran's activities in the region, I don't see them as malign. I see them as stabilizing. I see them as a necessary reaction to irresponsible policies undertaken by the United States, Saudi Arabia, and even Israel. So I'll start off on that. Israel doesn't have a leg to stand on in terms of a justified position. That's never stopped Israel in the past from doing things that people disagree with. But when it comes to Israel making statements about Iran, I think Israel understands a couple of realities. One, they're not as good as they think they are. And what I mean by that is one just simply has to take a look at the 2006 war with Hezbollah and the fact that the Israelis did not wipe Hezbollah off the face of the map as they had promised. Hezbollah didn't win that war in terms of decisively defeating the Israelis. They won the war by surviving. You know, we were told that the Israeli Air Force would annihilate Hezbollah. It did not. We were told that the vaunted Israeli Defense Force on the ground would close with and destroy Hezbollah. It did not. Hezbollah stood up and fought and, in many cases, prevailed against the Israelis. This is the reality. They're not as good as they think they are. You know who's good now? The Syrians are pretty good. Hezbollah is very good. The Iranians are extremely good. They've all learned the art of war thanks to the American-led intervention in Iraq in 2003 and the instability that's been engendered since then. But the Iranians aren't suicidal. They're not seeking a confrontation with Israel because they understand that a decisive confrontation with Israel would result in some detrimental things happening to their infrastructure and their economy. Iran is going to let Israel hang itself, and that's what's happening right now. Netanyahu may stand at Dimona and make a speech, but what's the reality? He's a prime minister under investigation for corruption. His political coalition is falling apart. There may be a need for elections that he will not prevail in. The situation in Gaza is deteriorating beyond his ability to control it, and Gaza represents literally a fraction of what would happen if he started a war against Hezbollah in Lebanon, or a war that involved Iran and Syria over the Golan Heights, for instance. Netanyahu is a lot of bluster. Israel is a dangerous nation because it does have military capability, but they don't have the capability to win. They can start a fight, but they can't finish a fight. And with a state like Israel that's politically unable to handle the kind of casualties that would accrue if a war with Syria or Iran took place, This is just chest dumping.
But hang on, Scott. They don't have to win, do they? Because if they were to get into a fight, the United States would be there to help them. Possibly Britain too.
Well, really? With what? I mean, what's the Great British Army going to deploy? The Great British Army can't even get a reinforced battalion off the island over to the Baltics to stand up against the so-called Russian threat. The United States is overextended. Our airplanes barely get off the ground anymore. We spend $700 billion, but we can't deploy large numbers of troops. Where are we going to get the troops to do this? How are we going to sustain the troops in battle? The day of putting 700,000 men on the ground like we did in the Gulf War is long gone. So what is the United States going to do? It's going to start an air-based campaign that it cannot sustain. And once again, Iran wins not by defeating the United States, but by surviving the attack, by waiting the United States out, by forcing the United States to negotiate a ceasefire, by getting the United States to withdraw under terms that are conducive to Iran, not the United States. So again, I'm not worried about this kind of, you know, irresponsible war, because any professional, military professional worth his or her salt knows that this is empty talk on the part of the United States and Israel. They don't have the military capability to sustain the kind of conflict necessary to defeat Iran, Syria, or Hezbollah. And the Iranians, the Syrians, and Hezbollah know this.
You're a former Marine, another Marine from a long time ago, a guy called Smedley Butler. He was involved in putting down an attempt to take over the US government by Prescott Bush just before the Second World War. He wrote a book called War is a Racket, the idea being that war is there really just for profit. There's a lot of talk about principles, but it's really about grabbing resources and making money.
Well, unfortunately, Smedley Butler was right then, and he's probably correct today. I mean, for the Marines who were my peers, and the group of Marines today that would have been my peers, they are honorable people. I will never denigrate them. These are men and women who are dedicated to the notion of service. Service doing the ugliest thing possible, which is engaged in armed conflict. I believe that there is a necessity for nation states to maintain militaries. For the sole purpose of defending their interests from the malign intent of others. The problem isn't the tool. The problem is the person wielding the tool. The military does not make the decision to go to war. The military simply executes the orders given to it by its higher authority. In the United States, this is a civilian government elected by the people, ostensibly. But we have a problem because the people are totally disconnected from this. If you take a look at Congress, they can't even agree to sit down and do what Congress is supposed to do, which is to, you know, manage the president's ability to go to war. They're unable or unwilling to talk about amending 2001 provisions that allowed us to fight the so-called war on terror so that it reflects the reality of the present situation. We have presidents and senators and congressmen who, although the vote may be from the people, the votes are paid for by special interests. And so until which time you take money out of the American electoral process, Smedley Butler's correct, because it's special interests who are driving the political power in the United States, and it's the political power, these so-called elected officials, who make the decision on how to wield the military power. So the military does, in fact, become little more than a tool of these special interests carrying out operations that match, you know, what's good for their corporate board as opposed to what's good for the American people.
I must also ask you, Scott, about your prosecution. You were prosecuted for online chat of some sort with an underage girl, some kind of sex chat.
The fact of the matter is today I stand convicted of a variety of charges. I went on trial and I was convicted. I'm appealing that conviction. I maintain my innocence. I said I was innocent then. I maintain my innocence today. And no matter what happens, I'll continue to say, I didn't do that. I did not have a sexual-related chat with an underage person. That never happened, and it never will happen. That's all I'm going to say about it. It didn't happen. There was not a sexual chat with an underage person. End of story.
Former officer in the US Marines and also weapons inspector in Iraq, Martin. He was actually at the time saying it doesn't look as if the Saddam has got any of these weapons of mass destruction, but Colin Powell begged to differ.
Well, he spoke at Bristol University some years ago, and he said to the audience, he said, well, in actual fact, when I was a UN weapons inspector, I was working for the CIA. So, in other words, I was basically a spy. And what I was telling my CIA handlers was, they haven't got any weapons of mass destruction.
What do you make of his analysis of what's going on today, then? That actually what's happened with the tension in the Middle East is that countries like Lebanon and Hezbollah, the Syrians now too, and Iran are actually growing stronger by all the saber-rattling by the Israelis.
Well, I mean, the fact is that the Americans didn't win the war in Iraq. The winners of the war in Iraq were the Iranians, and the current Iraqi government is aligned with Iran. That's the net result of them sticking their finger in. And ultimately, at the end of the day, the Americans are trying to project power across an ocean into a region where they don't have actually that much credibility, and the Iranians are going to beat them. If it comes to a fight, the geography is against the Iranians, against the Israelis in the West. The Gulf and the Mediterranean are basically death traps for NATO's warships. And if it comes to a fight, they'll all be in David Jones' locker in the first half an hour.
Also, the Guardian reports, this is September 2015, actually, it's a good while ago, that Russian vetoes are putting the UN Security Council's legitimacy at risk, says the US, and this is a Guardian exclusive, apparently. Warning over the body's failure to act on Syria and Ukraine comes on top of wider criticism of its structure and the permanent members' veto rights that we discussed there. They say Russia has used its veto powers four times to block resolutions on Syria that Moscow sees as damaging to its ally, the regime of Bashar al-Assad.
Well, the Americans have vetoed hundreds of times on behalf of the Israelis. So who's being the obstruction? Who's being obstructive here? The whole point of having the Security Council is you actually get to talk to people on the other side, and then you might be able to come to some kind of understanding. If you don't talk to them, that's not going to be possible at all, is it?
Made in Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Well, what about the Church of Artificial Intelligence? Now, that's a kind of crazy idea. It sounds crazy, but the ex-Google executive Anthony Lewandowski is founding a church where people worship an artificial intelligence god. That's according to, well, various publications, but the one I'm looking at is the Business Insider. He's a former Google and Uber executive, currently at the centre of a lawsuit filed by Waymo. He says he's serious about starting a religion centred around super smart artificial intelligence. Anthony Lewandowski is his name, Martin. Is this just a gimmick, do you think? Because the idea is, what he's essentially saying is that the super smart artificial intelligence is going to be something that everyone is going to want to be associated with, is going to learn from, and he says ultimately worship. It's called the Way of the Future Church. It's got its own gospel called the Manual, public worship ceremonies, and probably a physical place of worship too. He's saying he hasn't actually constructed a physical church yet. The idea behind his religion is that one day, not next week or next year, sufficiently advanced artificial intelligence will be smarter than humans and become effectively a god.
Well, I think that's a bit extravagant. I'm willing to accept that artificial intelligence is coming and it's going to change a lot of things. But why bring God into it?
I think what he's saying is that this organisation is, or that the AI would be super brainy, and therefore everyone would want to embrace it, should we say, spiritually.
Well, they might want to embrace it, but this still doesn't mean it's God, does it? It just doesn't make sense.
Let's have a listen now to a report on AI, which is looking at how powerful it is around the world. Maybe not a god, but certainly various world leaders think artificial intelligence is the way of the future.
The president of Russia has announced what he thinks is the key to global domination. Vladimir Putin said last week, quote, artificial intelligence is the future for all humankind. It comes with colossal opportunities, but also threats that are difficult to predict. Whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become the ruler of the world. The president also mentioned that Russia would share its knowledge of AI to prevent a single nation from rising above the rest of the world. Putin's comments prompted a response from Tesla and SpaceX co-founder Elon Musk. Billionaire entrepreneur said September 4th on Twitter that competition among nations to develop the best AI will likely lead to World War III. Musk added that a third world war, quote, may be initiated not by the country leaders, but one of the AIs if it decides that a preemptive strike is the most probable path to victory.
Well, I mean, if the AI thinks it's going to be Napoleon rather than God, it can still make mistakes like invading Russia and getting thrashed, can't they? It doesn't mean anything, does it? I mean, the stock market crash will be driven by the computers. Definitely. They will just sell, because that's what they're programmed to do.
No, they're also programmed not to cause a crash. That's also part of the computer programming.
No, they're not. They're not, in fact. There's a danger of an auto crash being caused by the logs that the computers have got. And, AI could be as stupid as anything else. Yeah? What if we're hit by an asteroid from outer space? Will AI be able to protect us from that? Quite possibly happened in 1905. An asteroid landed in Siberia, and fortunately, it was in the middle of nowhere. But it could have landed on a city, and if it did, then we would have been, we'd be talking about different things, wouldn't we?
I suppose the idea is you're thinking of various dodgy things that Google executives might be up to. Don't look for to search on Google. I found one thing this week was Mervyn King and his discussion about Brexit being possibly the best option. I was looking for that last week. I found it fine. I put exactly the same search terms in, Brexit and Mervyn King. This week, Martin, it didn't appear. So Google are actually messing with our minds, aren't they?
Well, they are. I mean, the creation of the internet was effectively carried out by the Pentagon in order to carry out surveillance of the population. That's what they funded it. And, you know, whatever Tim Berners-Lee thinks. And, you know, that's what they did it for. And, of course, they are now trying to use the logs that the, you know, Facebook and so on use to steer people to believe certain things about the way the world works, about, you know, provocations by the Russians, etc., etc. And, you know, we're constantly being bombarded with very sophisticated propaganda.
One of the most recent stories this week, and the big horrific story, of course, is Yemen. The Saudis and the UAE have blocked a UN call for Yemeni ceasefire, but this looks to me as if the Saudis are just doing the US and Britain possibly as well as dirty work for them.
Well, what the British have done is they brought forward the idea for the ceasefire to the Security Council, but the Americans haven't backed it. So the British can then say, oh, we tried to put a stop to it, but hey, what can we do? Meanwhile, the RAF are helping the and British Special Forces are inside Yemen helping the slaughter.
What's your analysis of the Khashoggi killing again? Because we're finding it now, it's become pretty clear that the Americans knew the guy was about to be killed.
Well, Sybil Edmonds, who used to work for the FBI and is Turkish origin and based in Turkey, thinks that it was an MI6, a CIA hit.
Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 8. Coming up live on Facebook, it's Mohammed Makawi. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.